shifting strategy to save a stranded orca.
So we can rule out the weekend.
For sure.
Encouraging signs that have the local First Nation putting the rescue on hold. A new twist in the Surrey policing fiasco.
There is a path forward that respects both the federal and provincial legislative frameworks.
Dueling letters and how the public safety minister is doubling down on the transition. And Canucks playoff fever comes with a price.
You can afford it?
Yeah. Been saving for 9 years.
Just 2 days from the first postseason game in nearly a decade, tickets are either hard to find or hard to afford.
You're watching Global BC. This is Global News Hour at 6.
Good evening. Thanks for joining us. Sophie is off tonight. We start with the fallout from decriminalization in Oregon and why it's a cautionary tale for the future of the pilot here in BC. Oregon is abandoning the policy, much to the relief of some downtown businesses. But as Paul Johnson shows us in the second part of his series, there are differing opinions about why it failed.
What city wouldn't want a company like Portland's Aurochs Leather? A family-owned business making handcrafted leather goods. Their products are impressive, but their location hasn't really worked out.
As years and months have gone by, you can kind of see that there is more drug use on the area.
After Measure 110 decriminalized hard drugs, Levi Martinez says it got way harder to keep people from using in front of his business and generally scaring away customers.
Before it used to be present, but it wasn't so blatantly obvious. Now it looks like it's just free for all.
Observations like that are part of why the state of Oregon has now flip-flopped on hard drug decrim. After about 3 years, using hard drugs will be illegal again in September.
So this is Portland's Chinatown. A lot of it boarded up and devoid of pedestrian traffic because of the open drug use and chaos here. People opposed to decriminalization say this is one example of why they think the project has failed.
Ultimately, I think people really need to understand this was political.
Tara Hurst helped lead the effort to implement Oregon's decrim. She believes it was ultimately sabotaged by police, big business, and politicians looking for a convenient wedge issue.
This is not a policy failure. The rolling back of decriminalization is because it was never implemented.
Hurst says the program helped some get into treatment. And if the rollout of money hadn't been so slow, many more would have benefited. She has this advice for BC.
Keep doing what you're doing and make fixes along the way. But this is not the wrong path. We're on the right path.
When they did decrim, did life get easier for you here?
No.
But back on the streets of Portland, the verdict was less clear. No one we spoke with had ever tried to get into the treatment programs. And several told us they thought decrim was a magnet for users from elsewhere and criminal drug gangs.
Especially like with the fentanyl thing, like people who like don't use but are selling to people, like it made it really easy for them.
In Portland, Paul Johnson, Global News.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says his government is still committed to decriminalization here. Speaking at the University of Victoria, Trudeau says the BC and federal government's pilot project on decriminalization is a science-based and compassionate response to the toxic drug crisis, and he says the program is going to continue.
We worked with BC on a pilot project to create a framework to support the approach that we're doing right now. We've already adjusted and tweaked it and are working with BC on that, and we'll continue to work very, very closely with them on making sure that it's working right.
BC's public safety minister says the federal government is on board with the Surrey police transition, despite some resistance from the RCMP. Mike Farnworth addressing today a leaked letter from the commissioner of the RCMP calling him out. Keith Baldry joins us now. And Keith, we've seen so many developments in the last few days in this never-ending saga.
Yeah, the story that just won't go away got another twist today. You talked about the commissioner's letter. Well, this is a letter that sort of trumps that one, to put it mildly, because it's from the Public Safety Minister of Canada, Federal Minister Dominic LeBlanc, writing to his provincial counterpart, Mike Farnworth, expressing the federal government's full support for the transition from RCMP to Surrey Police Service. So, again, this is a bit of a coup for Mike Farnworth, as the federal government now has allied itself with the BC government on shifting away from RCMP in Surrey to Surrey Police Service. Here's the minister today.
There have been a number of, I think, crucially important meetings, particularly the last several weeks, that have been able to deal with one of the, I think, the crucial questions that was outlined in the letter, and that is the path forward and ensuring that that the RCMP do not have to surrender their authority to another policing command, and that there is a path forward that respects both the federal and provincial legislative frameworks.
So again, the story, of course, is not over yet. Mike Farnworth, next week, will have another development announcing the estimated target date for the formal transition from Surrey RCMP, being the police of jurisdiction in Surrey, to Surrey Police Service. So the story continues. We'll see what that information is next week.
Can't wait for the next development. All right. Thanks very much, Keith. Have a good weekend. Vancouver police are under more fire tonight following our story about a young Indigenous woman who was punched by a VPD officer during an arrest after she kicked an officer. As Angela Jung reports, First Nations leaders claim it's another example of systemic racism.
It's taken some time for a young Indigenous woman to process being punched by an officer during an arrest.
I'm so much smaller than him. Like, he's like a grown man, and then he just like had no right to punch me for kicking him.
We've agreed to protect her identity. Vancouver police allege the woman was twisting the officer's finger, so he punched to release the grip. She denies pulling his finger while handcuffed.
Mostly, like, confused and, like, frustrated and upset.
Confused because she called 911 on New Year's Eve for help. The arrest happening in a space run by an Indigenous nonprofit agency.
It's not right. It's so contrary to what things are these days in terms of moving forward, in terms of reconciliation, in terms of building that relationship with the police department.
A friend who witnessed the confrontation says the officer was being rough with the woman even before the kick.
The least they could have done was just asked her to stand up. They did not have to use that type of force to grab her and pick her up, and then all three of them were basically on top of her.
Grand Chief Stuart Phillip is outraged by the incident. He says, "I found the video to be totally infuriating, disgusting, and heartbreaking. Another blatant act of racialized police brutality."
The systemic racism is deep.
A Hillsik Nation man and his granddaughter were handcuffed when trying to open a bank account in downtown Vancouver. A human rights settlement was reached with VPD. Part of that was for the two officers involved to attend an apology ceremony, but they were no-shows.
We really need to be able to, you know, trust, you know, law enforcement, you know, and we're a long ways away from that.
We asked VPD what initiatives were made after the BMO incident. It did not respond to our requests for an interview and instead referred us to this report, which outlines its strategies for engaging with communities, including Indigenous peoples. For the young woman at the center of all this, she says she's now traumatized.
Like, I can't trust the cops or anything.
Angela Jung, Global News.
The epidemic of property crime has forced another BC business owner to take drastic action and give up her storefront. As Janet Brown shows us, she says it wasn't the best thing for her business, but she had no choice.
I'm very angry and very frustrated at the situation.
Mandy Johnson used to run her stand-up paddleboard business from this shop in White Rock.
This was the first window that was broken.
Surveillance video shows the first break-in last spring. A person using a hammer to smash one of the shop's windows, taking a pair of sunglasses. Two more break-ins caused Johnson to decide to close.
It's very sad because people earn their living that way.
If businesses are closing because there's that big a problem, let's not become San Francisco.
At the hair salon next door, someone also tried to break in.
If you look at the door here, it doesn't shut flush. It should shut like that. And it's bowed out. So they tried to jimmy it open.
There's just so much crime nowadays, and it's like, I don't know what the... don't know what the answer is.
It's an absolute shame, but unfortunately, it's becoming all too common.
Local MLA Trevor Halford says business owners need more help tackling rising crime.
Businesses are getting vandalized and at a rapid level, and they're having to absorb the cost of that. And it's completely ridiculous.
About 6 in 10 BC small businesses report crime and safety issues as a significant challenge.
The Canadian Federation of Independent Business says the $10.5 million provincial rebate program launched last fall to help businesses grappling with vandalism is a good first start, but says it is not easy to navigate.
Unfortunately, we've heard that a lot of the money from the program that's supposed to be dispersed to small businesses has been kind of held up by a difficult application process.
Johnson says she didn't apply for that money, instead moving her business to her home.
Hello, it's Mandy with Sea Guide Stand Up Paddle Boards. How can I help you?
But she says it is not ideal.
People are finished with COVID. They want to come back to the stores. They want to see the products in their hands.
For now, the space that Johnson moved her business from still sits empty at the corner of Russell and George Streets. Janet Brown, Global News.
Well, for the first time in nearly a decade, Canucks fans can watch their team play a playoff game on home ice. But along with the soaring level of excitement is the cost of tickets at Rogers Arena, pricing out many fans. Aaron MacArthur is outside Rogers Arena for us tonight and has a little more on these playoff prices and how people are responding. Aaron?
Chris, it's a bit of a good news, bad news situation. The bad news is prices are certainly more than most would hope they would be, but the good news is there are still a lot of tickets available. If you go on the Ticketmaster website, tickets are being resold anywhere between $300 and $600, less than it might be in a market like Toronto, but still a lot of money. Interesting to note that Nashville, the team Vancouver is playing, has put in a locals policy only. You need a zip code in the Nashville area in order to purchase a ticket. That's not the case in Vancouver. And the result is skyrocketing prices, pricing many people out.
And it's a treat. And it's my first playoff game. I've been a fan for 30 years. So I work hard for it, and I'm happy to spend that.
We were hoping maybe we could get in for a couple hundred bucks, but I don't know.
No, I don't have the cha-ching to make it into the playoffs this year, but I'll be watching from wherever. I'm hoping that there'll be a street party or something. I'll pay $5-$10 to, you know, see it on the big screen in front of the stadium. That'd be pretty cool.
Demand is starting to grow, but this is what's scaring a lot of people, is the prices.
So the schedule for the game, Sunday night here, Tuesday night here, and then the series shifts back to Nashville. The Canucks have just announced that it will open up for those games in Nashville. $15 a ticket. You can go inside and watch the game on the Jumbotron. Certainly a better deal than $300 for the home games, Chris.
At least you'll be in the company of fans, too, and enjoying it together. Aaron, thanks very much for that. All right, the world has been watching the plight of a BC orca calf stranded in a lagoon near Zabelos. So far, the attempts to encourage it to leave the lagoon have failed. But there are some encouraging signs today that give rescuers hope that a new strategy might be more successful. We'll have the latest developments for you next on the NewsHour.
This environment element doesn't exist without a continuum, right?
Still to come tonight, big changes in Stanley Park and for its longest resident. Part three of our series on the Welcome Squatter, Chris Bailey. Plus,
I think we have most of Surrey here out on that day.
How to prepare for one of the largest Vaisakhi celebrations in the world. That's coming up later. Right now, though, an encouraging new development has effectively put the Vancouver Island Whale Rescue on hold for now, and it means there's less urgency to get her back out to the open ocean. Our Cassidy Moscone is in Zabelos to show us how this new strategy is evolving. Cassidy.
It definitely was a huge development, Chris, for the entire team here on Hattusat Land, who've been in Zabelos now for nearly a month. That's how long Brave Little Hunter has been stranded. We're told a number of those experts and volunteers have been sent home while the crew regroups and decides their next move. It's a sight the entire Ahadasat First Nation has been waiting to see. Kwisa Hayes finally feeding.
Got it.
The two-year-old orca calf eating seal meat like she would in her natural habitat. It's the first confirmed meal she's eaten in 27 days.
I think it was joy, really. I think the joy of the meal.
And seeing that now gives us some options, gives us time. Given that she was showing subtle changes in body condition, it's real important that she's getting those nutrients, so we're really happy.
It's a game changer for the nation and DFO, who were prepped and primed to make their second rescue attempt Friday, a multi-day mission with dozens of experts from around the province now put on hold.
We're looking at all these options about how we can use, first of all, make sure the animal's healthy with seal, but also, yeah, using as an attractant to move the animal within the lagoon, possibly out of the lagoon.
For the first time, we can share with you Kwisa Hayes's cries for help. Her calls recorded by researchers using a hydrophone, likely gone unheard by her pod out in open ocean. Brave Little Hunter's welfare sparking interest from all over BC, from musicians hoping to serenade the killer whale to safety, to the Prime Minister.
I think we're all following this story attentively. It is heartbreaking, and we're all worried. So I have ensured that Department of Fisheries and Oceans has reached out to the community, and we're going to continue to engage with them.
In the meantime, Ahadasat First Nation has launched a GoFundMe page to recoup the costs of housing and feeding the team, working on a long rescue mission that's not over yet.
No, not at all. So, Cassidy, is the latest development moving the goalposts? What kind of timeline are we looking at now?
That's really up to Kwisa Hayes. There is a lot of variables at play here. As we know, the crew were ready to hit go on this rescue operation today, but when the orca calf started feeding, that just changed everything. Luring her out of the lagoon with food is looking like the least disruptive option. Using cranes and slings is another method that they're keeping in their back pocket. We're told it could be a few days, it could be a few weeks. We will keep you informed when we know.
All right, thanks very much, Cassidy. That's Cassidy Moscone up in Zabelos for us. Now, a father in the Upper Fraser Valley has a warning for motorists. The warmer weather is bringing motorcyclists back onto our roads and increasing the risk to people on two wheels. Travis Prasad reports.
Hot rods and motorcycles, a shared passion between father and son.
Just been riding motorcycles since he was 4.5 years old.
This is Gage Turner's motorcycle. On April 12th, around 4 p.m., he was riding it near Hope when he got into a crash. RCMP Highway Patrol says his bike collided with the back of a sedan. The 19-year-old was airlifted to Royal Columbian Hospital. Along with multiple broken and fractured bones, he had a brain bleed and blood clots in his lungs.
The arteries in his neck were damaged from the impact.
He was placed on life support, but pulled through, regaining consciousness 5 days after the crash.
Once we got to talk to him, we realized that his cognitive functions seemed to be fairly intact. He didn't remember anything about the accident, and we would prefer it that way.
Word of Gage's injuries shocked the tight-knit community of Hope. They quickly organized this fundraising car show for the young man.
A generous, caring, humorous kid in the community, like an actual pillar to Hope, especially amongst the young community. He's organized his own car shows. He's a huge part of Brigade Days.
Hot rods and classic cars cruised along Highway 1 on Thursday, friends and family using Gage's automotive passion as an engine for support.
Most of us think their kids can't do anything wrong, and we tell them they're wonderful and that we're very proud of them. But when the town comes together and feels the same.
So far, more than $30,000 has been raised through the car show and an online fundraiser. The Turners hope their pain will be a reminder to all motorists, whether on two wheels or four.
You're cruising down the road and you're just loving life. Pay attention to what's around you. Make sure your head's on a swivel, because you don't know what's going to happen. You just don't.
The crash is under investigation. Meanwhile, Gage is on a new road, hopefully to a full recovery. Travis Prasad, Global News.
Coming up, No Limit Cycling.
The response has been absolutely phenomenal.
The Sydney Volunteers making sure everyone gets a chance to go for a ride. And after living in Stanley Park for more than three decades, why artist Chris Bailey might need to find a new place to call home. For 34 years, Chris Bailey chose very discreetly to make Stanley Park his home. And he's seen firsthand the changes in that forest. Tonight, in the last of Global's three-part series, we look at the 74-year-old's unique perspective on that evolving landscape. And Alyssa Thibault joins us now live. Alyssa, he's had such a fascinating life, but the experience is coming to an end.
Yeah, Chris, and the changes in Stanley Park are part of the reason for that. Now, thousands of trees are being cut down around Chris's camp. He's now more exposed than ever. Tonight, we explore where he could go next and what he's learned along the way.
It's easy to see the physical changes of Stanley Park through the years. The once lush forest is becoming a shadow of its former self, particularly around the campsite of the park's longest resident, Chris Bailey.
You could hear singing, that type of thing. They're all gone.
Living in the park for 34 years, Chris notices every difference.
That one stream there used to be a flow of water year-round through there. And right in this one location, the owls used to come in every morning and bathe. Really beautiful. They don't do that anymore.
He says certain birds no longer visit. The trails are busier and it's louder.
Sure, I get hundreds of these in the week.
Does that bother you?
It does, yeah. Hundreds in the week, right? And more in the summer.
More recently, with the infestation of the hemlock looper moth, thousands of trees are being cut down and removed in droves. But Chris is surprisingly at peace with it.
What's that like when you see all the big logs being taken out of here?
Life goes on. This environment element doesn't exist without a continuum.
So too must Chris's life go on, and he knows it. He started preparing to leave the park in 2019.
I did not wear, say, blue jeans for a couple of decades, and I only wore blue jeans as a token experience in reinterfacing with society a couple of years back and purchasing some jeans to see what it felt like.
But the process of leaving stalled.
Not having an ID, is a big thing. And
without a passport or any identification, Chris has been unable to secure housing. And officers with the Vancouver Police Mounted Unit don't want to put him on the streets.
I never wanted to go and forcibly remove someone who I know wasn't, had any criminality. Chris is like many people who have found themselves in the park. Going down to the downtown east side into a SRO is just not an option.
When I first met him over 20 years ago, he was a younger man that was jumping around the logs and showing me different blades of grass within the forest. Now it's not so much. He's a little bit slower. It's remarkable that he's been out here this long.
The question now is, where could Chris live after spending more than 30 years living in solitude in a forest?
Living the way he does, it's going to be very difficult for him to go into housing, he'll find it really claustrophobic.
Even Chris isn't exactly sure what's next or how long the move-out process will take. He has an interest in becoming an artist in residence somewhere or living in shipping container housing, even going back to Montreal. But he does have one desire.
If I can locate ideally in a natural setting.
He wants to stay connected to nature. The VPD say they're in the process of getting him to this next stage.
We're going to be getting his passport and making sure he's got all his ID so that as he transitions into housing, which I think he's ready for.
This post is an element of carving.
The man Chris is today is vastly different from the person who started on this journey in 1990, a former bartender and corporate worker who made a conscious decision to change everything.
I could call myself enlightened. And you know, I shed a lot of burdens, a lot of light patterns of thought and application began to emerge much more spontaneously. That's a maple.
Those who've known and helped him along the way have been moved by his story and are as curious as anyone to see what happens next.
I do know that I'll stay connected to Chris by email, text, I do. I look forward to seeing what his next chapter is going to be.
You know, in the universe, the only positive outlook, you know, to put out is life goes on.
Yeah, such a good outlook about it. Alyssa, you mentioned it briefly there. We've had an enormous amount of feedback about Chris's story. A lot of people really care about him.
Yeah, we've just had so many notes from viewers interested in helping. There's been an amazing amount of interest in his art. I have spoken with him these last few days, and on behalf of Chris, thank you to the viewers who have been writing in. We are seeing all of your messages. He does have a team around him, members of the VPD, the Park Board, the city. They're all working with him on these next steps. We will be following up on what happens from here, so stay tuned. Chris.
Very cool series. Thanks very much, Alyssa. All right, we're going to take a short break. Still ahead, cycling without age.
A wonderful feeling to get out and bring joy to others.
The BC Bike Gang bringing everyone along for the ride. Plus, Surrey's Sikh community getting ready to host the city's biggest street party of the year. Well, the tents are ready, the food is cooking, and the excitement is definitely building for the big parade tomorrow in Surrey. Let's bring in our community reporter, Safia Pirani, now for more on Khalsa Day and the big Vaisakhi parade.
That's right, Chris. I'm here at the Gurdwara at 128th and 85th. And, you know, it's such a great evening tonight. And, you know, as you can see around me, crowds are already gathering ahead of tomorrow. Now, volunteers and businesses have been here since early in the morning, getting the food set up and the stalls ready. And there is a lot of excitement in the air. The Surrey Khalsa Day Vaisakhi Parade is known as one of the largest in the world, and organizers are expecting a crowd of around 700,000. Vaisakhi has deep-rooted religious and cultural significance. It marks the birth of the Khalsa, as well as a spring harvest season. And people are looking forward to tomorrow to celebrate faith and community spirit.
This is an event where it's like it's so broad, multicultural, accepting in its universal principles of human rights. I think we have most of Surrey here out on that day, and especially on a good day where there's good weather. People bring their families out, they get to mingle with one another, they share in food with one another, and it becomes just a great family event. And we, as the Sikh community, get to talk about who we are as a people.
It's a food for public, like we are making kadhi chawal, rajma chawal, and some sweet stuff, and for everybody.
It's fun. Yeah, like we get to like meet our family and stuff like that.
And eat some yummy food.
Yeah.
Now the Nagar Kirtan is set to begin from around here by the Gurdwara at about 8:39 a.m. And just a heads up for everybody, road closures will be in effect. This is from 72nd Avenue to 88th Avenue and between 132nd Street and 122nd Street. And traffic control begins as early as 7:30 a.m. So people are being asked to please prepare ahead of time, prepare for delays and be ready for that traffic control. And we will be here bright and early in the morning, bringing you the latest coverage from Vaisakhi. Back to you.
All right, good advice, and look forward to that coverage tomorrow too. Safia Pirani in Surrey for us. Thanks very much, Saf. We'll check the weather forecast with Christy in just a moment for that parade. Also still ahead, pedal power.
They're thankful. They got a smile on their face.
What might be the best way to experience Sydney by the Sea coming up? And in sports, helmets in soccer? The Whitecaps player who really stands out for more than his skills. A group of Vancouver Island volunteers has found a way to spread joy through cycling, but these bikes are built differently. As Kylie Stanton reports, the group uses specialized tricycles to take people for a ride who might not otherwise get the chance.
Hello. Hop on a bike and the wheels start turning.
We went for a ride in Victoria on one of these and we said, Sydney has to have one.
5 years later, the Cycling Without Age Society has become a fixture here.
The response has been absolutely phenomenal from the community.
The rides are offered free of charge to seniors, complex learners, and really anyone who wants to take one.
We're inclusive for all ages, right? All ages and abilities.
These custom Trishaw bicycles, now a lifeline for those seeking connection to the place they call home.
When they're out on a ride, everybody in the community is waving at us, they're interacting with us. It almost brings tears to my eyes. It's just such a wonderful experience.
The growth can only be described as exponential. In 2019, the Society provided just 100 rides. This year, more than 1,000 are in the works, all of it powered by volunteers.
It's just a wonderful feeling to get out and bring joy to others and to get people outside to feel the fresh air, the wind in our hair.
Some of our passengers are a little bit reluctant when they get on the bike, but all of them, when we're finished the ride, they're thankful.
I love everything about it.
They got a smile on their face.
Thinking it's lovely.
And they look forward to doing it again.
Now it's a matter of meeting the demand. The fleet is set to expand, with a fourth donated Trishaw arriving in June. And the hope is to see the service and its reach grow right along with it. The good news, with 20 volunteers ready to go and another 15 in training, it should be like riding a bike.
It's a wonderful program. Everybody should try it.
Kylie Stanton, Global News.
You know Kylie had a blast shooting that out in that beautiful blue sky and sunshine. What a day it was today. And, of course, we're talking about the Vaisakhi Parade and what the weather will be like through that. It should be pretty decent too, right, Christy?
Yeah, I mean, we've been advertising this system that's going to move over quickly, but it looks like it's not going to move in till late in the day Saturday, keeping us dry for most of the day. But I would definitely recommend everyone sort of front-end load your day. I wanted to also talk about this. Yes, the Abbotsford Tulip Festival happening at Lakeland Flowers, and this is 35 acres of over 100 varieties of tulips. If you've never been out there, you really have to. It is stunning, just the immense amount of colors. And the cool thing that I learned is that this year they're actually going to extend this festival right through the summer into September. So once the tulips are gone, they're going to change over to peonies, and then they're going to change over to lavender, and then change over to sunflowers. So I'm going to be checking those out. Really cool indeed. Really important to remind you, though, get your tickets online, because it may take a while for them to process in the morning as you're trying to get in. So get your tickets online, and you can actually get a discount if you buy it the day before. This is the change that we're talking about. So we'll wake up to sunshine, but quickly we'll see increasing cloud. There's a slight chance of a shower in the late afternoon, but it's more so in the evening hours. And you can see that here as this system takes over. Dry through much of the day, certainly for those of you in the interior regions, but then that system moves across. Most of the wet weather will happen overnight. On Sunday, a mix of sun and clouds, still a slight chance of showers, but overall it certainly not a washout this weekend. So there's your forecast, everyone. Beautiful conditions right across the area. Lots of sunshine for those of you in the interior, but again, South Coast area will see increasing cloud in the afternoon, certainly with cooler conditions, and a bit of wind also, I should mention, but that chance of showers hopefully not shifting in until the evening hours. Tonight, Central Windows weather window comes to you from Victoria, where Karen captured this photo of a mom hummingbird feeding her babies. Certainly a sign of spring. Thank you to Karen for that.
Beautiful shot. Mm-hmm. How tiny must that little baby be? I feel that looks familiar. We might have, had that one before?
Oh,
maybe
not.
When you weren't here. Maybe
oh, really?
Here. Maybe. I don't know. We'll have to check the tape.
It's the week for birds feeding.
Maybe.
Oh, that's funny. We have a system in the weather department where you're supposed to click on, like, highlight it if you've used it before. It wasn't clicked.
Oh, no, okay. Well, maybe it's
maybe they're two different birds.
Maybe it's a different one.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Squire's here now.
Yes, I am.
We Guess talked earlier about here. The Canucks.
Guess who else is here?
Nashville Predators.
Nashville Predators are here. They arrived this morning. And, of course, one Nashville Predator that Canuck fans know very well is Luke Shen, who cannot wait until Sunday for Game 1.
Obviously, I know this fan base and the way people have been starving for playoff hockey. It's going to be exciting.
which means Luke Shen is going to hit some of his old friends, probably more than once, I'm guessing.
They better be prepared for it. Also tonight, satellite debris.
Whoa, you just invented
automated doors.
Going to be a big series here between Canucks and Predators.
I think it'll be a better series than the Canucks Predators won in 2011. Because the Predators, they were a decent enough team, but they're a little better now. That's the one Ryan Kessler just dominated back in 2011. Anyway, that's old history. The Canucks took the day off today, but the Predators arrived this morning and they practiced at Rogers Arena this afternoon. Now, of course, they lost all three regular season games to Vancouver this season, but those games were early in the year. After the All-Star break, the Predators had the third-best win percentage in all of the NHL. Here's an interesting little stat. The Predators have more BC-born players on their roster than the Canucks. There's Dante Fabbro, Tyson Barrie, and Colton Sissons, who is with Barrie right now at Rogers Arena.
With North Vancouver's Colton Sissons, who has spent his entire 10-year career with the Predators, drafted in 2012. But the year before then, of course, Nashville and Vancouver played. You're 17, playing for the Rockets. Were you cheering for the Canucks? You can come clean. Were you cheering for Vancouver in 2011?
Before the draft, I certainly was. Yeah. I was a big time Canucks fan growing up. So, yeah, I think it was 2012 that changed it for me.
Of course, everyone knows the story about you two. You guys were supposed to go to the concert. Barry Trotz didn't like the way you guys got throttled by Dallas, and so he canceled it. I mean, how much? When you look back, did that really play a big role in how you played, or was it just a great story?
I mean, I think it was just a funny little detail that people took off and ran with and thought it was pretty entertaining. But, I mean, obviously we just, you know, we got our butts kicked at home pretty bad to a divisional opponent. Nobody likes that. So I think that got us more in gear than any concert would have.
You're a proud North Vanner in the NHL. It's been pretty good recently. Connor Bedard, Macklin Celebrini could be number one. What is there something in the water in North Bend? What's going on?
Yeah, there's got to be. We've had some good hockey players over the year on the North Shore for sure, but some of these young kids are pretty special, so hopefully we keep turning them out like that.
How many in the Colton Sissons cheering section for games one and two?
We'll see. I know there'll be a few pods of buddies and family and whatnot, but we have a pretty good crew of Smashville supporters here, so hopefully we can continue that.
Well, I'm not sure if you've seen the Canuck ticket prices, but at least you guys can afford them, so that's not the worst thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've been hearing about it.
Okay. All right, Colton Sissons and the Predators ready for game one Sunday. Squire, back to you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Now, we all know why hockey players wear helmets, but what about soccer players? When they go up for a header, there is always a danger of clashing heads. Obviously, most players don't wear headgear, but Whitecaps defender Bjorn Inge Utvik does.
It's quite easy. It's a good fit, huh?
It's a piece of soccer equipment rarely seen, especially in the professional ranks. But it's a permanent part of the ensemble for Whitecaps defender Bjorn Inge Utvik, who signed with Vancouver this past January after playing the past six seasons in his native Norway. Utvik suffered a serious concussion about 9 years ago, which led to the head protection.
I went for some doctor and specialist to figure out how to deal with it the best way. And then they recommended me to play with this helmet for a year. But now the helmet came a part of me, so now I just go with it. So then my mom back home feels safe also. I think most of them just use it for a couple games, so like a few months, and then they bring it away. But I think it's quite nice. I look better with a helmet.
Soccer can be a dangerous game, especially with a clash of heads. You would think more players would consider wearing the helmet permanently, but that's not the case. Legendary goalkeeper Peter Cech famously wore one for a long time after fracturing his skull in a violent collision. That was an extreme case. But concussions happen all the time in pro soccer. Whitecaps forward Brian White missed a game earlier this season with one.
I've never actually worn a helmet that he had. I've worn like a headband helmet before. I've put a mouth guard in after the last concussion just trying to do a little something to help prevent any headbanging around. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, if it works for you, if you feel more comfortable with it, then all the power to you.
Utvik embraces the helmet as part of his identity on the field, which certainly makes him stand out and actually does set a good example for young soccer players and fans.
If I see someone at the top level that he takes
prevention against concussion seriously, maybe we have some more kids taking them and not complaining if they have to wear an helmet or any kind of devices that need to help me be better, be safer, and be healthy.
Udvik has not had a concussion since he started wearing the helmet 8 years ago. And it's not like he plays a tentative game. He's not changed his aggressiveness one bit.
It's a little bit because of my playing style. I'm really like rough and go into every duel with my soul and my head. So I try to do everything to defend my goal. As long as I'm a little bit more safe, I'm happy. So I go with a helmet.
Barry DeLay, Global Sports.
Whitecaps are in Seattle tomorrow night. RBC Heritage Golf Tournament, four players at minus 11. Hadwin's minus 5. Svensson's minus 4. Taylor's minus 1. Mackenzie Hughes of Ontario is one off the lead. There you go.
All right. Thanks very much, Squire. And we'll be back right after this to end the week with satellite debris. All right. Jordan Armstrong is standing by right now to preview what's coming up on Global News Hour at 11. Jordan.
Chris, it is the eve of 420, and that means marijuana enthusiasts are preparing for tomorrow's unsanctioned gathering at Sunset Beach. We'll hear from people living in the area as well as police. Plus, a man who was once named Canada's smartest person is in trouble with the Law Society of BC. Find out why at 11. Chris?
All sounds very intriguing. Thanks very much, Jordan. All right, on the eve of 420, let's talk about snacks.
Yes, that's very good, because Cheetos, I mean, if you had a Cheeto stand tomorrow, you'd probably make pretty good money.
Probably do all right.
All right, so that's what we're going to start with, Cheetos.
Man, why don't they make doors that, like, open themselves?
Whoa. You just invented
automated doors.
Come on, why can't you do this yourself?
Did your face just unlock that phone?
Car doesn't drive itself.
We're gonna be rich. I'm gonna be rich.
No, I am going to be rich. Filthy, filthy rich.
I get
Cheetos
it.
Cheetos is done for the planet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so these two are from Allstate. There we go.
I'm a guy who lost a bet and my dignity. As if watching my team lose wasn't punishment enough. What are you looking at, huh? What are you? It's a one speed.
And if you have cut rate car insurance, odds are you'll be paying for that yourself. So get Allstate and be better protected from mayhem, like me.
Hey, I'm walking here.
I'm a bird stuck in Larry Bird's attic.
And I'm going cuckoo.
What the heck?
What you got, Larry? May the best bird win. Rick.
You may be a legend on the court, but you're an amateur up here.
Heads up, Larry. So get Allstate. Save money and be protected from mayhem, like me. Now
ideas.
You're the bird stuck in the attic.
Seriously.
Yeah, I know.
Like, who thinks that that idea? Good.
Somebody who's at the 420 festival tomorrow. That's
I think so.
All right. I was at the one last year, I guess. Okay, mm-hmm. Let's go back to Cheetos since we're all on this sort of snack thing. Here we go.
Why
back
not?
To
99% of people eat Cheetos with their dominant hand.
Mr. Guy?
Even sketch artists.
We'll catch him.
And sports fans.
Oh, and he's done it!
And bakers.
Cake.
And football players, and even plastic surgeons.
How's it look?
Using your other hand, it's a Cheetos thing.
There you go.
Enjoy safely and responsibly. The Cheetos.
The Cheetos.
Tomorrow.
or whatever other munchies you may come up with.
You may come up with, or whatever else you're consuming. Okay, last word on weather before we go.
Yeah, so we are going to see sunshine in the morning. Quickly, though, increasing cloud in the afternoon. And the rain, we're hoping not until the evening hours. Try and front-end load your Saturday, everyone.
Hold off on the rain. There's a flag football jamboree out in Coquitlam tomorrow. We'll see if it works. All right, have a great weekend, everybody.